If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's episode, you'll hear an interview with the historian and classicist Daisy Dunn. Daisy is the author of In the Shadow of Vesuvius, A New Life of Pliny, and she recently wrote a cover feature on Pompeii for our sister magazine, BBC History Revealed. The editor of BBC History Revealed, Charlotte Hodgman, spoke to her to find out more about the ancient volcanic eruption and the town that it destroyed.
So you've written a piece on Pompeii in our recent issue. Perhaps you can just maybe recap for listeners, you know, what happened on that fateful day. I mean, did people in Pompeii have any idea that Vesuvius was about to kind of erupt?
I think really this the eruption of Vesuvius came as a massive shock to everyone who was living in Pompeii, Herculaneum, sort of the other towns and villages of Campania. It was early afternoon, one day in AD 79, and suddenly this enormous cloud began to appear out of Mount Vesuvius in the distance. And that was really the first sign that people had that something strange was afoot. And we have the testimony of a 17-year-old boy who actually witnessed this, and he was staying in the house of his uncle in the Bay of Naples with his mother as well. And his uncle was Admiral of the Fleet, and he decided to go and have a closer look at this strange cloud that had appeared. And he was just about to sort of board his ship when he received a message from someone who lived closer to the volcano. And she said to him that there's now no escape except by boat. So really quite rapidly, the situation deteriorated, and Pliny the Elder, as this man was called, decided to sort of launch a rescue mission and sail across the Bay of Naples with his fleet of boats to try and rescue people. And there was really no indication that this was going to happen. I mean, for the previous few days, there'd been earth tremors, but earthquakes in this part of the world were really, really common. So people didn't really think there was anything significant about those. And people didn't know that Vesuvius was a volcano. At the time, it hadn't erupted for 700 years. It had been dormant for 700 years. So people just thought it was a mountain. And it was really richly covered in vineyards because this is a great sort of wine-growing region. So people had no idea. So it was they were completely taken unawares by it.
Mm. And you mentioned just now that that Pliny's friend said that there was no way out apart from by boat. So why was that? I mean, did it when the eruption started, because this massive cloud came up, didn't it, and then kind of it kind of collapsed on itself. Was it that kind of stopped people leaving, or was it kind of they didn't have time to leave? What was kind of preventing people from going?
Well, there was a mixture of things, really. The cloud was the first indication. So I think that cloud stage, people would have had some warning and time to leave. But soon this cloud began to rain pumice down heavily upon them. And this pumice was raining so heavily that it actually formed island-like masses on the water. So anyone who was trying to escape by boat found that they were actually sort of impeded by the pumice itself. There was also the problem that sort of the wind direction was wrong for quite a few people who were trying to get away. So Pliny the Elder and his fleet actually found they wanted to try and reach this friend who'd asked for their help, but they found that they couldn't get close enough because of this pumice that was floating all across the water. So they had to put in somewhere else instead. And they put in at a port town near Pompeii, which is called Stabiae.
Okay. And I found this quite remarkable that he actually then stays the night, doesn't he, and stays in Staby Eye rather than kind of leaving. And actually that was kind of to prove his downfall, really, wasn't it?
It was. Poor old Pliny the Elder. He sort of, I think initially he really was just curious about this cloud. He was a natural historian as well as Admiral of the Fleet and had written this encyclopedia of natural history. And it was really clear to me that he obviously wanted to make some observations about this cloud. But once it's turned into a rescue operation, obviously that wasn't a priority anymore. And so once he'd reached Staby Eye, he bumped into another friend of his, and he really tried to put him at ease and tried to carry on as normal as much as possible. So you sort of hear of him having dinner with him and having a bath and then sort of spending the night at his villa. But that night is actually crucial. It's during that night that the earth tremors that they felt for days actually intensify to such an extent they realize that if they stay inside that villa, they could well be trapped. The whole villa could come down on top of them. So they decide to escape while they can. And Pliny the Elder has this ingenious idea of getting pillows, strapping them to their heads, and then venturing out into the danger zone. So the pillows hopefully sort of soften the blow of all this debris that's now falling from the cloud they've seen on the previous day. And he came to the coast, and he was hoping really to try and find a way out. But the wind was against them. The sea was very, very wild because of the circumstances. And he just found himself unable to escape, and he seems to have died by being asphyxiated by the volcanic cloud on the beach.
I mean, that's one of the interesting things is the length of time, because I think when you imagine Vesuvius erupting, you think, you know, it erupts and then sort of there's you know, lava cascading through Pompeii, and you know, and that's what kills everybody. But actually, there was sort of a good 24-hour period, wasn't it, when it was sort of building up to this big, you know, the sort of the lava and all that type of thing. And actually, a lot of people died through sort of suffocation, from all those poisonous gases. Do we know how many people actually died, or you know, did many people manage to escape?
This is a really difficult question to answer, partly because a lot of this area still has yet to be excavated. So we don't know how many bodies, human remains, still remain unfound. What we do know, in Pompeii, about 1,000 bodies have been found. And sort of estimations of the population size of Pompeii at this time vary, but some people sort of say between 10 to 15,000 lived here. So that would suggest that the majority of people did escape, but it's very difficult to sort of say exactly how many.
And of course, Herculaneum, which was a neighbouring town, was actually closer to Vesuvius, wasn't it? And that's also quite a famous sort of town that has been excavated. I suppose that was worse off than Pompeii. Why is it that Pompeii is kind of the city that kind of resonates with people so much?
It's difficult. I mean, I think Herculaneum is fascinating. I mean, out of sort of the two to visit, I find Herculaneum, you sort of get a truer sense almost of what it was like to live in a Roman town. Herculaneum really bore the brunt of the eruption, because I think it's about 7 kilometres from Vesuvius, so incredibly close. And the people living there, sort of famous stories in the 1980s, they didn't think that many people had died there, but suddenly in the 1980s they looked in these sort of boat stores they have had along sort of what used to be the shore, and they found a lot of skeletal remains of people who'd sort of tried to save themselves by piling inside these shelters for protection. And they found that a lot of those skeletons belonged to women and children, and a lot of the men would have given up their places and sort of died on the beach instead. I mean, Herculaneum is absolutely sort of haunting place to visit. I think Pompeii is almost overwhelmingly large. You sort of walk around and you're sort of seeing incredible things, but I think Herculaneum is just that little bit more manageable. So I think it deserves to be on sort of every tourist map, really, just as much as Pompeii does.
You mentioned that you kind of get a real sense of Roman life from Herculaneum. What in particular kind of, you know, strikes you or has been found there that kind of gives you that impression?
I think the grandeur of it is really surprising, even though it's a smaller place. So the sort of population size we think is more like 4,000 to 5,000 compared to sort of 10,000 to 15,000 of Pompeii. But the villas which have been excavated there are something else. There's one in particular, the Villa of the Papyrus or Papyri, which actually contains the largest collection of Greek and Roman sculptures ever found in one building, as well as the oldest surviving library from the Greek and Roman world. And it's enormous, and it goes on and on and on and on. And you just find it's full of these incredible works of art, mosaics, sculptures. And it's not alone. I mean, there are sort of several others. I think it was a real sort of attraction for sort of the wealthy people to have these great maritime homes with wonderful views looking out to sea. So you get a real sort of sense of this kind of luxury that existed there before this terrible disaster.
And going back to Pliny the Elder, who was it? Was he quite well known? He must have been quite, if he was admiral of the fleet, he must have been quite well known across the region.
Yes. I mean, he was sort of amazingly versatile as a man. So he was born sort of around AD 23-24, and he grew up sort of followed a sort of military routine. So he served as a soldier and had sort of several campaigns in Germany, and then became a historian and sort of documented sort of the German wars, lots of his own sort of experiences there, and then sort of became sort of most famous for this encyclopedia of natural history, which really encompassed sort of everything that was known at the time, or at least everything that they thought they knew. And a lot of the time he was wrong. And sort of you can read the encyclopedia today and think, how could he possibly think that about women or whatever, or childbirth or whatever else? But it was sort of he was a great figure for sort of wanting to preserve everything that had been found. I think he was very conscious of the fact that human memory only lasts so long, and he kind of saw it his duty to record as much as he possibly could, whether that was history, natural history, as well as sort of having this great military career and sort of serving. He served the emperors as well. He was in the sort of imperial administration before he became admiral of the fleet in his later years.
And you can see why then he would have been interested in going to investigate the big cloud that he saw. His nephew, also Pliny, he sensibly stayed, didn't he, to continue his studying while
he
his
did.
Uncle went, which was a very sensible plan in the long run. What he inherits, doesn't he? He inherits his uncle's library and all his documents and things like that. What does he go on to do? Does he follow a similar sort of path to Pliny the Elder?
I think he really very much sort of wants to take his life in his own direction. He's very conscious of the fact that he's living in the shadow of this great figure, his uncle. And he inherits his name effectively. He's actually sort of adopted posthumously by his uncle. So that's why he's known as Pliny the Younger, even though that's his maternal uncle. And he tries to carve out his own career, really. He immediately joins a law court in Rome. It's a civil court, and it sort of specializes in wills and inheritance. And he becomes a senator as well. And he establishes himself really for sort of taking on sort of a series of legal cases. Also, the fact that he's living in very difficult times. I think we all sort of think of Nero as being sort of the real terrible sort of emperor at the time. But Pliny the Younger sort of finds sort of the new Nero in Domitian. And Domitian was the emperor that he had to serve sort of for a considerable time in the Senate of. And it was just a very, very difficult time. I mean, Domitian put to death a series of Stoic philosophers, for example, who Pliny counted as friends. And Pliny is kind of implicated in this because of his position in the Senate. And the astonishing thing really that makes Pliny the Younger special is he actually wrote a lot of letters, and these have been preserved. So these letters sort of document Rome in this period. So he talks about everything from the eruption right the way up to the ascent of Emperor Trajan, who was a sort of a considerably better emperor, who Pliny the Younger also served.
And so what do we find out from his letters? I mean, that's our own, one of them is, some of them are our only source, aren't they, for what happened when Vesuvius erupted?
Yes, exactly. So there's two on the eruption of Vesuvius, and they're the only eyewitness accounts we have of the eruption. And he takes us from his viewpoint. He stayed behind with his mother at a port town called Misenum, which is where they originally were when they saw this cloud. So it's about 30 kilometres from the volcano. So he describes his own experience, how he managed to escape and survive, and then what happened to his uncle as well, which he would have heard reports from other people. And he wrote those two letters to the historian Tacitus, and Tacitus was sort of the great historian of the age. He went on to write the great annals of Rome, all about the Roman emperors. And he was about 5 or 6 years older than Pliny. So there's a sort of series of letters between them, which are very interesting, sort of document sort of the ins and outs of Rome and the age. Other sort of highlights there are the first sort of pagan source on Christianity, because Pliny the Younger was actually dispatched by Trajan to a Roman province in the east, in what is now Turkey, in his later years. And it was kind of an administrative role. But Pliny the Younger encountered Christians there for the first time. And he was completely bewildered. He'd never really come across them sort of face to face, and he was quite sort of taken aback and didn't know what to do. And he actually took it upon himself to question and in some cases torture and put to death the Christians that he encountered. So it's a very, very dark side of Pliny, which comes as, I think, a real shock. It comes sort of at the end of the 10 books of his letters. You come across this letter and you think, gosh, this is such a different viewpoint from, you sort of build up a picture of who Pliny the Younger was, and then you come across that and you have to sort of change how you feel about him, rather.
Yeah. And what does he sort of, does he shed any light on sort of day-to-day life, the kind of, you know, the mundane things of it, or does he kind of more concerned with, you know, politics and things like that are going on in the empire?
It's a real mixture. And I think that's why the letters are so interesting. So one minute you can be reading about sort of the nitty gritty of the politics. The next he's sort of waxing lyrical about his fruit trees. he, one of the things Pliny the Younger actually collected, as it were, sort of villas across Italy. He's almost like a property developer in his own time. He had sort of villas around Lake Como, which is where he was born. One in sort of modern Perugia, one on the west coast of Italy, one in Rome. And some of these villas had spectacular gardens, and he was really keen on sort of growing sort of fantastic topiary. Some of it was shaped as his name. He had sort of Plinius written in topiary in one of them in his garden. And he used to sort of make his own wine as well, or at least he had sort of slaves making his wine for him. He used to go in and sort of taste the must and sort of feel like he'd actually contributed something to this process by doing that. So you kind of get sort of a mixed picture, and sort of, I think he's concerned with that. So how do you live a life sort of richly and fully? I mean, he was very keen on trying to establish a legacy for himself through his political work. At the same time, he considered it important to sort of take daily exercise and sort of go out for a long walk every day, a long ride. And then he sort of had this sort of very quite fixed routine to try and get the most out of life, so that he was enjoying himself. At the same time, he was sort of establishing this legacy that he really sought.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
That's what makes it so haunting, I think, and so exciting. That's the real sort of enigma of Pompeii and Herculaneum and sort of all of this part of the world. Just the fact that there is so much that you can see that was there, but knowing that there's still so much that remains hidden, it's like alive. It's still alive, even though it's dead.
And so he lived, was it Misenum you said he lived in?
So he lived most of the time in Rome. Misenum is where he was staying when he saw the eruption.
And he does actually return to Pompeii, doesn't he, later in his life?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that, because what struck me from the writing is how the area had kind of revived.
This is the real surprise. I mean, he says probably about 20, 30 years later, he goes to stay with a friend in sort of the area. We're not sure if it's exactly Pompeii or if it's nearby. So it's in that neck of the wood. And I think as a historian, you look at the letters and you think, okay, he's going to say something about how worried he is about going back to this region where his uncle died. Nothing. You don't find anything like that. He doesn't express any concern about revisiting the place. In another letter, he tells us that his wife had been unwell, and she actually decided to go to that region as well. And he was all for it, because even though the eruption was sort of 20, maybe maximum 30 years previously, this area had kind of regained its reputation as one of sort of having immense health benefits and being very, very fertile and very good for sort of recuperating from a lengthy illness. And that's sort of astonishing. I think you sort of you imagine sort of Pompeii and Herculaneum being absolutely sort of obliterated by this disaster. And I think it sort of takes, we now know, at least 20 years for vegetation to return to this sort of hitherto very, very green area. But sort of as soon as it does, people are going back there and obviously sort of revitalizing everything that sort of it was, and sort of rethinking of it, thinking of it again as an area which was incredibly healthy and sort of bountiful.
Did anyone try and rebuild in either of the two towns? So in Herculaneum or Pompeii, did anyone come back to actually live there?
Not directly on the areas that were sort of the heart of the cities before. But, I mean, one of the poets, there's a poet called Statius, who sort of says he's actually from Naples. And then he said he's sort of amazed that he thinks people already sort of can forget what had happened, like, with the disaster, because people are starting to sort of build, I guess, slightly further out, but they're still sort of coming to the same area. And he thinks as soon as it's going to look completely green, people are not going to remember this tragedy at all.
And that's just incredible, because like you say, you know, today when you visit, you know, you see the ruins, and it's all kind of quite you imagine it being quite barren, don't you, and sort of no one ever coming back. So to think of people kind of going back to that area so soon after it happened.
I think it's just because, I mean, Campania itself, and we're not talking sort of about the actual sort of epicentres of the ancient cities, we're talking about sort of the broader area, which was still sort of affected by the volcanic eruption. It was just, it was amazingly fertile, and that was partly to do with the volcano itself. I mean, I think one of the ancient historians actually talks about the fact that Mount Etna in Sicily is very, very fertile at the soil, and is very, very good at sort of growing vines and things because of the sort of the volcanic nature of the soil. And I think the same is clearly true of Vesuvius. One of my sort of favourite ancient wall paintings shows Vesuvius as it looked before it erupted, and it has the wine god Bacchus standing in front of it. And Vesuvius is nothing like sort of how you imagine it to look, and it's completely verdant and green and covered in all these wonderful grapevines that are still growing up the lower slopes. And I think the sort of temptation to sort of, you know, embrace Campania again as a sort of very, very healthy region was just too much.
What do we know where, I mean, only a few thousand people have been found, haven't they? Or few have been found, or their remains have been found in Pompeii, but had a quite large population. What happened to the sort of refugees who had to flee the city? Were they sort of catered for? Did the Roman government step in and help them?
We know that, the emperor at the time of the eruption was Emperor Titus, and he'd only been emperor for a few months, really, when this eruption happened. But he immediately got to work to try and help those affected by the disaster. So he actually hastened to the Bay of Naples, and he set up a sort of panel of senators who'd be put in charge of sort of restoring what was possible to be restored, and sort of raising funds to aid the relief effort. And the point is that he was sort of adamant that the privy purse would not benefit from the disaster whatsoever. And you have to sort of appreciate, I mean, how much he had on his hands, because we think of this sort of affecting the Bay of Naples, which it did. But we also know that volcanic dust was actually carried as far as Egypt and Syria as well. So, and sort of Rome was affected by it at all. They saw sort of, it went very, very dark during the eruption. So, and this dust over time actually was said to have spread sickness and pestilence among the survivors. So the emperor really had a huge project on his hands, really, to try and restore and salvage and really help the survivors as much as he could.
And presumably Pliny the Younger's mother got out. She went with her son.
Yes, she seems to have survived, and then we never hear of her again in Pliny the Younger's letters. So, but yeah, she definitely survived.
Okay. And then it isn't really until the 19th century, is it, that that Pompeii's really kind of is rediscovered. How was the sort of city found again?
It was a sort of a series of processes. So as early as the late 16th century, we hear of an Italian architect who actually stumbles upon the ruins of Pompeii while he's actually just digging a canal. But it's only about 150 years later that they start to excavate the city. And it's Herculaneum, which actually is excavated first. And this is in the mid-18th century. And there's a Spanish military engineer who's sort of put in charge of these excavations. And they're a bit haphazard, to be honest, sort of in both places. There's a bit of sort of prioritising of actually rescuing these fantastic wall paintings and treasures and things which are found, rather than actually trying to shore up the remains. But in terms of the actual human remains, that's when you're sort of looking at the 19th century. There's an Italian archaeologist. He also specialised in coins. And he discovers a method for actually pouring plaster into the cavities left by the bodies discovered at Pompeii, so that you can actually make these very sort of visceral casts of the dead. And he uses this technique. And if you've sort of visited Pompeii, you'll see a lot of these casts, which really sort of bring you, I think, as close as you possibly can to the dead.
And they're incredibly detailed. I mean, you know, down to facial expressions and things like that, aren't they?
They are. It's really haunting to look at them. I think sometimes you have to remind yourself that you're not just looking at a sculpture or sort of, you know, a sort of a modern rendering. You're actually looking at you know, what remains of a dead person. It's very sort of sends a shiver down your spine.
I mean, what amazes me actually when you look at a map of Pompeii's is how much there still is to excavate. There's a huge chunk. I mean, you say it was a very large city, but you know, there's big chunks of the city that we haven't even looked at yet.
Exactly. I mean, I think there'll be so many people being thinking, gosh, can't you just dig up the rest and want to see? I mean, what else lies hidden? What else haven't we discovered? But there has to be sort of quite a lot of work on sort of actually preserving what has been exposed to light already. And that's kind of where the priority has lain over sort of the last decades or so. Having said that, sort of most recently, I've been really, really excited to read about a lot of the discoveries which have been made. They've been excavating a region called Region 5 in the north of the city. And this area had not been excavated until now. And it's part of this sort of 105 million euro great Pompeii project, it's called. And they've uncovered astonishing mosaics and wall paintings, which tell us a lot more about the city and sort of about people's sort of, you know, interest in the myths, for example. And they've sort of uncovered things like a fantastic, they used to have these fast food bars, and that's sort of how they've been described. They were sort of, the rich tended to sort of eat at home in Pompeii, but for sort of the poorer people in particular, there were these sort of bars which served hot food. And they've discovered one of these, and they're sort of beautifully painted. You wouldn't have necessarily thought that, I think.
No. And the bakeries always fascinate me as well, with the big bread ovens, and you can almost kind of imagine, can't you, what it would have been like to have lived in such a bustling Roman city.
You can. And seeing those very round loaves, sort of perfectly scored into segments, so you can sort of tear and share them.
Was it a typical sort of Roman city of its day?
I'd say it's more typical than Rome is. I mean, it's considerably smaller. It's about 160 acres, I think. And sort of bearing in mind, Rome's population is more like a million compared to 10 to 15,000. So I think it's probably more typical of Roman towns at this time. Obviously not quite as sort of extravagant. You don't find exactly the same sort of public monuments as you would in Rome, but it's still a very, very accomplished place. I mean, there's fantastic sort of, it's a great amphitheatre, there are theatres, there's sort of beautiful forum and baths and all kinds of amenities that, you know, a well-functioning city should have. And the roads, I mean, that's one thing when you sort of visit Pompeii and you see all the roads, and I think it's fascinating, you see sort of tracks left by the carts sort of still in the roads themselves. And it's sort of amazing when you see little features like that to remind you that it was very much a sort of bustling, you know, busy Nice.
Definitely. And several months ago, a plaque or something was found, wasn't there, that actually sheds light on the date of the eruption, putting it probably more likely to have been in October, 79 AD. What's your kind of thoughts on that?
Well, this has been sort of the one question. We have these sort of two letters that Pliny wrote about the eruption, but the one sort of most contentious issue to have come out of this is when exactly did Vesuvius erupt? Because most of the manuscripts of his letters seem to say it happened on the 24th of August. Mm. But then when people look at the actual archaeological evidence, it seems very, very strange because they have sort of evidence of autumn fruits, for example, which have been harvested, lots of pomegranates. And the wine seems to have all been harvested and bottled and put away. And that just would not happen in August. So for a long time, people have suspected it's more like October or even November. And as part of these latest series of excavations, they found an inscription in Pompeii. And this inscription refers to a date in October. And the tantalizing thing about it is that inscription is written in charcoal, and charcoal does not survive for very long. So the a reasonable assumption would be that inscription belonged to the year in which Vesuvius erupted, so AD 79, and sort of shows that it could not have happened in August. But it still remains, I mean, that inscription doesn't tell us exactly when it did erupt. It's not conclusive evidence. I mean, this is the sort of thing, we keep coming across things which seem to give us more of an indication that it is a sort of a deeper into autumn date, but we can't seem to put our finger on exactly when that happened. But one thing, I mean, I'd say is that the Romans had a slightly different calendar from us. And in the Roman calendar that Pliny the Elder describes in his encyclopedia, late August is actually autumn in the Roman calendar. So whichever way you look at it, I think from my perspective, it's clearly an autumn event, whether it's August or whether it's October.
I mean, it seems strange that something so significant, you know, that the date could have been lost. I mean, was it not recorded somewhere in Rome, or, you know, a government, you know, you'd have thought somebody would have, it seems quite a simple thing to have kind of recorded.
I mean, it's possible that another document will come to light.
Yeah.
And there'll be, you know, we'll get sort of confirmation once and for all. I mean, I think the difficulty, I don't think that Pliny probably wrote the date wrong. I don't think, having been caught up in that disaster, it's likely he'd have forgotten which month it happened.
No.
I think, you know, with his letters, which put it in August, I think probably there was a scribal error. You've got to think people have been copying these letters, and then there's been copies of copies, and then sort of any kind of error is then perpetuated and passed on down the generations. And this is very, very common when you have sort of a range of manuscripts. You often get sort of the wrong detail, which is then perpetuated.
It remains a really fascinating topic, and, you know, you just kind of know that there's going to be other things, you know, big things to be found, and
what makes it so haunting, I think, and just so exciting. That's the real sort of enigma of Pompeii and Herculaneum, and sort of all of this part of the world. Just the fact that there is so much that you can see that was there, but knowing that there's still so much that remains hidden, it's like alive. It's still alive, even though it's dead.
That was Daisy Dunn. Daisy's book, In the Shadow of Vesuvius, A Life of Pliny, is available now, published by William Collins. You can read her feature on Pompeii in the latest issue of BBC History Revealed magazine, which is on sale now. Daisy will also be speaking about Pliny the Elder at our History Weekend in Chester this October. You can find out more at historyextra.com/events. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Thursday when Henry Hemming will be discussing MI6's secret campaign to bring America into the Second World War.